You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and today my co-host is a former standout student athlete and California native, Marvin Smith. Marvin became an academic scholar and pre-med student at California State University at Fullerton, and he went on to play in the National Football League. Following his days as an NFL linebacker for the Oakland Raiders and Los Angeles Rams, Marvin created a pathway toward helping youth as a community leader and a social entrepreneur. He is the founder of Micro Enterprise Academy, which was later named the Doris Topsy Elvard Academy, a charter school foundation and community-based youth enrichment program that integrates technology, leadership, and entrepreneurship education. But his love for community outreach is reflected by his commitment to the giving back and teaching younger generations how to develop and build their own communities through effective leadership. Now, Marvin earned his master's degree in business with an emphasis in organizational management and leadership from Azusa Pacific University, his bachelor's degree in psychology from California State University of Fullerton, and is an ordained minister. But what I'm most proud to say is he's my friend. Marvin, thanks for being here with us.
Well, Alan, thank you for having me on today.
Now, some things are now changing as Marvin is coming in and working with us, but other things aren't changing. And each week we will continue to bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, with each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors sharing valuable stories and helpful information who are working to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound and make this world a better place for all of us. And we will continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family.
And on that note, that brings us to our guest today, George Kimmeldorf, who has a PhD in mathematics from the University of Michigan and retired as professor from the University of Texas at Dallas. He shared with us that he thought he knew the path to happiness as defined by his parents, friends, and society, married a wonderful woman, raised two lovely children, having a successful career, and became wealthy. But there was something missing. He was not happy, and he became that person, the seeker. So now our guest has published a book, Seeker to Finder, Discovery Everyday Happiness. George, welcome to Answers to the Family.
Thank you.
Hey, George, it is great to have you on. And I got to tell you, I think that there are a lot of us that go through a period of time in our life to where we think, you know, maybe I'm not as happy, you know, as I thought I was going to be. And a lot of people do different things. You know, they'll go out and try and search for whatever it is that they think that they're missing. Not as many people actually go out and write a book about it. So tell us, what brought you to that point to where you decided, not only have I gone through the journey, and not only have I found some things, but I'm going to write a book about it so that I can share it with other people?
Well, that's a great question. I really am not an author. I did not intend to write a book. But as you know, I really discovered happiness, and I was teaching it to somebody else. I'm not a professional teacher. I don't charge any money, but I was just teaching it to somebody. And we were actually doing it over the internet. And after about a year or so, she said, you know, why don't you take a transcript of, you know, what you had taught me and let's make it into a book. So that was my original motivation. We pretty well discovered that that doesn't work, okay? Taking this transcript and making it into a book really doesn't work. Anyhow, but that was the motivation. That was really what had me write a book. As I say, I had no idea I was going to end up being an author.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that are in the book and some of the things that people can do every day to boost their happiness. I think when everybody gets up, if they could have just a few things, what would some of those things be?
Well, let me tell you the first thing. The first thing is very simple and very effective, and that is just to feel and express sincere gratitude. Now, I say sincere gratitude, I mean what you're really grateful for, not gratitude for things to which you should be grateful for. Your teachers tell you you should be grateful for. Your minister tells you you should be grateful for. But just notice the gratitude you have for little things, things that you can truly be thankful for. Let me give you an example. I'm going to give some silly examples. You go through a stop sign. You're rolling through a stop sign slowly, hoping there's no cop there. There's no cop there. You got away with it. Yeah, have gratitude for that, you know. Have gratitude your backache is gone. Gratitude I've got money for groceries. Just gratitude for little things in life. You don't have to be big things, but there are just so many things in our life for which we can be grateful. And what happens if you actually do this, don't just think about it, but really do it, until it becomes habitual, you'll find yourself happier. You can't be miserable when you're experiencing gratitude. So that's the first thing. It's really simple. And just make it a habit. I park my car at the airport, and when I get home a week later, my car is still there. Hasn't been damaged. No flat tire. I can have gratitude for that.
Hey, George, this is Marvin. Yeah, I'm listening to you, and I got a big smile on my face, so I'm looking over to Alan. We're both smiling. And, you know, because what I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, it just seems like what you're saying is when you wake up, being thankful for life, just...
Yes.
All those little things in between and just grateful. I mean, it sounds so simple, which it is, but I think, as you're saying, it's one of those things we have to do it with intent. And that leads me to say, well, why do you think finding happiness is such a challenge for so many people?
By the way, yes, you're right. It does take intent because we don't have the habit of doing that. And the reason that happiness is such a challenge for many people, it's just they're looking in the wrong places. In our culture, we teach that the way to be happy is to become wealthy. Or if you're not going to become wealthy, become wise. Get educated. Material success. We teach people that a way to get happiness is get the approval of others. But none of those work. And I'll show that to you.
Okay.
Look at successful actors. They don't seem to be happier than other people. Look at CEOs of large corporations. You read all about them and how many millions they make. They're not happier than other people. Politicians, not happier than other people. Here's the real interesting thing. Lottery winners. You'd think that you'd win the lottery, you'd be really happy. Psychologists have studied lottery winners. They're easy to study. And if you think they'd be really happy after they won the lottery, you're right. They're ecstatic. They are really happy after they won the lottery. But you look at those people 6 months later, a year later, they are no happier than before. I mean, it's amazing. But that's people have actually studied that. So one of the reasons that people find it challenging is because we're looking in the wrong places. And this is what our culture teaches us. The second reason that some people find it so challenging to be happy is they believe that they have to earn happiness, like a reward for a righteous life. They may even believe that they don't deserve to be happy. So that's certainly an impediment.
Mm-hmm.
Third reason, since you've asked, happiness is an experiential skill. You have to happiness. You have to learn the skill of happiness, like learning to drive a car. It's challenging to teach yourself happiness. It's challenging to teach yourself how to drive. And it's the kind of thing you really can't learn from a book. My book, and by the way, the name of my book is From Seeker to Finder, From Seeker to Finder. And it's really an introduction. It'll point them in the right direction. It'll head them in the right direction and sort of show them, you know, how to go, whatever. But you're not going to learn happiness just from reading a book. It takes more.
For me, George, it reminds me of the days when I was playing sports, becoming a professional athlete. It was one of those things that, you know, I just didn't wake up one day, walk on the field, and said, I'm great. It was years of practicing those little things over and over. So it just became a habit. And that habit became, it took me to a different level in the game, so I was able to play professionally. But you're right. It's not something you just, it's something you have to do on a regular basis, and those little steps over and over makes the difference.
Yes, that's exactly right. You're right on. You said it perfectly. It's like learning a sport and like learning any kind of skill. But the interesting thing is that happiness can be learned. In other words, you don't have to be a special kind of person to learn happiness. You don't have to be a football player. Anybody can learn the skill. It can be learned.
Well, George, and you bring up a great point when you talk about, you know, the people that win the lottery, and then after about 6 months, they go back to sort of like their set point, or sort of like wherever it was that they really were, or were, you know, or where they learned to find their happiness. How can we change that set point?
But Alan, I want to say something just before you go there, because I'm chuckling. I wouldn't be happy either if I had relatives I'd never seen before now knocking on my door wanting all my money.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yes.
So I know when you talk about that survey, there's been surveys done also on people that have been in a serious accident and are now a paraplegic or, you know, things like that. And they've also maybe gone through a depression, but they've kind of gotten back to that set point. So how do we retrain our brain? How do we make the changes necessary so that we don't either fall back to what that point is or, you know, in one way or the other?
Now that's a great question. And by the way, a lot of people have studied this, and they've studied the set points. Well, the first thing you can do is what I mentioned before, is get in the habit of practicing gratitude. Actually make it a habit, day to day, minute to minute. And there's more you can do. The second thing you can do, and this takes some work, as you say, some dedication, is monitor your self-judgmental thoughts, the mm-hmm. thoughts you have about how you should be different, how you should be better. Thoughts like, I'm not good enough. Thoughts like, I shouldn't have done that. I'm not smart enough. I'm not thin enough. Even thoughts, I'm not happy enough. All these self-judgmental thoughts cause a lot of unhappiness.
Right.
And what I'm suggesting is just be aware of such thoughts. Don't, in the beginning, don't try to change them. Don't try to make them go away, all right? Because, again, then you're going to have the thought that I shouldn't have those thoughts, okay? You'll be back in the soup again, okay? So the thing you can do, be aware of those thoughts and be aware of the unhappiness that they cause. It will become clear to you that those thoughts are a principal source of unhappiness. The source of unhappiness is not your boss, not your spouse, and believe it or not, not your mother-in-law. Okay? So this is what you can do. Just be aware, monitor those thoughts, And then after that, there are lots of techniques. Like if someone asks me, well, you know, I want to be a good football player. How do I do that? Well, I can't summarize that in 30 seconds, okay? But there are techniques. You can actually learn the art of happiness. And I do, in my book, From Seeker to Finder, I do actually outline those techniques. And I've just told you two. And there are many others. Meditation is another one. But again, knowing really how to do this. And the other thing I actually suggest it strongly in the book, is to find a teacher. If I wanted to learn to play the violin, I'm not going to teach that myself. I'm not going to learn to be a track star or a football player. I'm going to need a coach. I'm going to need somebody who knows how to do this, has had some success. So that's another thing I suggest. If you're really serious about happiness, you can start off with gratitude, start off with listening to your thoughts, but if you're really serious about going on this path and really finding, as I say, being a finder rather than a seeker, I'm suggesting a teacher.
Then, you know, George, that's, you know, those are good good points that you're making. And what I would, at this point, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about how people would think. And what are the common mistakes that people make on that path to happiness? As you were just sharing a few, as you were a minute ago. But what would be some of those common mistakes?
Well, I think some of the common mistakes that people make, I mean, I talked about, well, some of the common mistakes, for example, they read self-help books, okay? And I've actually found out, for me, self-help books mostly were counterproductive. Self-help books are oriented toward making changes in our external circumstances. If you do this, you'll be happy. You know, if you get the right, get the right spouse, you'll be happy. If you divorce that spouse, you'll be happy, okay? If you do this, you'll be happy. So they talk about changing the circumstances in your life in order to get happiness. And that doesn't work. Other self-help books tell us how to improve ourselves, okay? They right. tempt us with a better future. I'm going to be happy when I, do this. I'm going to be happier when I do that. That has two flaws in it. First of all, it's a way of criticizing yourself. And secondly, it puts happiness into the future. I'm going to be happy in the future when I do X, okay? And the future never comes, as you know. You're always mm-hmm. in the present, okay?
Right.
So being happy really involves learning how to enjoy the present moment. Right now, this instant, we are talking on the phone. I'm happy, okay?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And any one of the listeners, people who are listening, the opportunity is to be happy right now. Accept yourself the way you are. Love yourself the way you are. And if you cannot accept yourself the way you are, then accept the fact right now that you can't accept yourself the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of paradoxical.
Well, which brings the question of, okay, you're talking about self-help books and some of the flaws. How is your book different from other self-help books out there, to where you've been able to avoid some of those pitfalls?
Well, my book is different in that first of all, I've had the experience of going through these self-help books, and my book is different in that it really teaches that happiness is an experiential process. It really teaches that we can be happy all the time, and it points out all these mistakes that many of these other self-help books make. Are you familiar with diet books?
Oh, a little bit.
Yeah, people read diet books because it's going to have them lose weight. So what happens is they read a diet book, And, you know, what may even works for a while. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But they don't lose any weight permanently. So they go out and they buy the next diet book. And when that doesn't work, they buy the next diet book. There's a tremendous market for diet books.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true for self-help books. There are just lots of self-help books that are out there. I guess this is what I want to say, that some of these things are addictive. Like when I mentioned winning the lottery or getting a raise, let's give that as an example. You work really hard, you want to get a raise, and you get the raise, okay? And you feel great. You have this high. Hey, I just got a raise, and you celebrate, and you tell everybody about it, whatever. It's a momentary high. It's addictive. It's really like any other kind of addiction, that these things make us happy over a very short period of time, and then you use the word set point, we're back to where we were. You know, I had a lot of experience in a university. I got my promotions, and I was very happy. Is the president of my university any happier than the janitor who cleans his office at night? I don't think so. You know, I don't know. I just don't know.
You know, George,
very interesting questions.
And as you're sharing that, for me, what I hear again is we're always looking for we're always looking for that gratitude or that adulation outside of self. Everything is dependent upon how someone makes me feel. How, you know, it's external versus internal. And what I hear you're saying is very much motivated from internal.
Yes. Exactly. That is what I'm saying. That there was a book many years ago saying happiness is an inside job, okay?
Yes.
And that's correct. The way to happiness, you're never going to get happiness by changing external circumstances. It's just not going to happen. You get these addictive highs, but it's not going to bring lasting happiness. People keep trying, and it doesn't work, okay? And that's how my book, From Seeker to Finder, really points out, to a large extent, what doesn't work. It points out, to a large extent, how to break that addictive habit of looking for happiness outside of yourself.
Right, and I think...
So my book... Excuse me.
Oh, and I was saying, and I think what else we hear in this is... You know, when you were making the analogy to the diet book is that it isn't about changing a book or it isn't about changing who you're listening to or who you're talking to. It's about changing the habit. Change the habit that you have made inside of you to a habit of gratitude, a habit of appreciation. Make these habits things that are so positive and so powerful inside you that happiness will come with that.
Exactly. And these habits are mental habits. Exactly right. Changing the mental habits. And they're hard to do. It's hard to change. Anybody who's tried to change habits knows that it's hard to do. It's not going to come in 10 minutes.
Well, you know, George, I as a minister of the Word of God, the Gospel, I see it day in and day out where individuals, you know, they come because they're seeking. But change doesn't happen until that person earnestly inside themselves are ready to make the change. You could preach a sermon all day long. It sounds great. We can hoop and holler. We can do all the things external. But until a person, and I can look at myself, I'm not going to point a finger, look at myself and says, until I was ready to make a change, and then by a habit and being motivated, make steps each day, is when I saw that true happiness in my own life. So I concur with what you're saying.
Yes, very, very true. And that's one thing that I have a lot of gratitude for myself, that I came to that point in my life when I, you know, really made the commitment to be happy. And a lot of people never get there. So I just have a lot of gratitude and a lot of thankfulness that, you know, I say, I was a seeker, and I, you know, there are a lot of seekers out there.
Yes.
Well, George, I'm thankful to have you on here. We're going to take a break for everybody out there listening. We are talking with George Kimmeldorf. The subject is happiness. And if you want to follow along with us, you can open up another screen on your computer. Go to FromSeekerToFinder.com. You can follow along with us. Obviously, if you're driving, don't try that. We're going to take a break now, and we will be back in about 1 minute. Stay with us.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our topic today is how to discover everyday happiness.
And George, I have a question for you. As we're listening and the listeners are listening, I'm a young person, not for real, but I'm going to act like I'm young right now. And we're in a society where our youth are being bombarded by the media. Look this way, feel this way. All this stuff is being pressing them from the external. And, you know, and we look at, as research tells us, neuroscience, you know, the brain doesn't really form until you're like age 25. So they're being bombarded by all of these issues, and it's defining our kids, our youth, and it's not good.
And yes,
my question would be for you: if you were a younger version, what would you tell yourself how to be happy?
That's a great question. In fact, one of my fantasies, one of my dreams, is be able to teach children in school the art of happiness. I don't think that's going to happen in my generation or even the next generation. But you're right, we're bombarded by all these things, totally bombarded these things, and, you know, TV all around us. And it's really hard, I think, to show a child that those things are not the source of happiness. It's very difficult, and I think the answer is you can't explain it to a child. You have to be it.
Model it.
Mm-hmm. Model it. Do it. Be it. Be someone. Be a parent who experiences gratitude. Be a parent who expresses gratitude. Be a parent who expresses love, compassion,
you know, George,
acceptance.
That's really great what you're saying, because in the world of behavioral science, you know, we call that behavioral modeling, you know,
right.
Be it, just don't talk about it. And, you know, my wife and I, we always use this term, even with our own kids as we raise them, we use the term, it's what's caught, not what's taught.
Yes, very well said.
Absolutely.
There are particular nerve cells that are, I forgot what they're called, that actually do mimic, you know, they make us yawn when other people yawn.
Called mirror neurons.
Exactly, mirror neurons. That's exactly what I was thinking of. I couldn't think of that. Mirror neurons, yes.
Yes. And I think that's another thing, too, as you're saying, teaching happiness. I think part of the direction that I see in education today is this whole notion around emotional intelligence, you know, empathy. And I believe that's kind of an attempt in that direction of trying to teach happiness. But that's a whole nother world within itself.
Now, George, one of the things that I think you touch on in your book, and that is how interpretation plays a pivotal role in determining one's happiness. Talk a little bit about how one can change the interpretation in regards to the events that allow us to make a difference outside ourself and in the world.
Yes, we live in the world of interpretation. That is, you know, you and I don't see the same world. And in fact, that's even true literally. There have been a lot of people who've studied the fact that we don't, you know, I see outside and you see outside and we don't see the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Our brains interpret. That's what brains do. We live in the world of interpretation. And so the whole way to do this, if you're going to find a point to make a difference, is to make that point in that interpretation. How do you interpret the world? Again, it's the idea of your thinking, the thoughts that you have, your interpretations of the world. And we always live in interpretation. Someone says something and you say, oh, he means that, she meant that, whatever. We're constantly interpreting. And one of the things we can do very easily is just question that interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really right? Is that person that I think is X, is that person really that way? Mm-hmm. Did he really mean that? Should I feel insulted? Constantly just, or another way to say this is don't believe what you think. Because what you think is interpretation. Just doubt it. Consider the possibility that what you think you know is wrong.
Well, and yes, I would agree with that. But I think also you have a situation as far as interpretation that many of us will, you'll learn more about the other person based on the way that they keep interpreting something. There are situations that I will find where something will be said and somebody will interpret that. And they'll somehow have found a negative way to interpret that. And I'll say, you know, I don't understand how you got to that point. You know, there's a couple of ways to look at this. You know, you seem to have chosen something that's pretty negative. And in fact, I can recall telling somebody one time, you know what, let's start from this paradigm. And that is, interpret what I say in the most positive way that you can, and I'll let you know if it's any different. You know,
okay. Yeah. That's good. Yes. That's a great idea. I like that.
Yeah, because it's frustrating sometimes. You know that you go, well, you know, just because there's maybe a lot of a negativity that's put out. I mean, we all have heard the thing about the media that if it bleeds, it leads. You know, they want to push with the most negative thing possible. That doesn't mean that we have to embrace that in our lives. We don't have to look at the negative part out there. It doesn't mean that it's not there, but it doesn't mean that we always have to interpret everything in the worst possible case.
Yes. And I think, too, Alan, I think about, I call it deductive reasoning. You know, you're right. Interpretation, it varies across the board. And, you know, we always use this term, the iceberg syndrome. You know, a lot of times what we see is the 10% of the reality. And that 90% is which is underneath the iceberg is where the real drivers are at.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone's always coming with this negative interpretation, it makes you think it looks right on top, but something is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to get to those drivers. And I think switching from a negative interpretation to positive, and that positivity is so powerful, is getting people to move in that direction on that scale.
Right. And George, which brings me to the question of what were some of the major difficulties that you ran into as you were trying to put this book together? Did you find that there were some negative forces out there trying to steer you in a different direction?
Well, yeah, the interesting thing is that the negative forces were all internal, okay? Yeah. I'm a terrible writer. That's a negative thought I had, okay?
Okay.
Okay? I can't do this. I can't finish this chapter. It doesn't make sense. It's not coming out right, okay? I had this huge amount of negative forces, okay? But they were mostly internal, okay? Mm-hmm. That was, I didn't have anyone, you know, I didn't have anyone out there telling me I couldn't write or I couldn't, you know, whatever, do it. But it's all this internal stuff. And I had to overcome that. It is really true. I'm not a skilled writer. I didn't learn how to write. I didn't, you know, it's a skill. Like, by the way, I'm good at playing the piano. I like playing the piano. I can play the piano. I never learned how to write. It was not one of my skills. And so that was an obstacle. Just my own negativity, my own feelings of, hey, I couldn't do this. I can't do this. And I was actually very lucky in terms of writing the book that I got a lot of help. I say my former student started out really, she started out almost as a co-author of the book, and then she moved to a foreign country and had to quit. But I had people who helped me with proofreading, with grammar, so I had a lot of help. And most of the people who worked on this book with me did it as an expression of gratitude. When I wrote this book, I had no intention of making money from it. I'm not going to make any money from this book. It's costing me a lot more to promote this book than the $2 I get for royalties for each copy I sell. So there's no motivation to make money in writing this book. And also, no motivation of fame, adulation. Oh, people are going to really recognize how bright I am if they read this book, okay? So I've gotten to the point where I know that those things aren't going to bring me happiness. So there was no motivation in that direction. But I was very fortunate. I had a group of people who worked with me and really helped me put the book together. And the real, call it a problem if you want, is actually getting the book out there. There's not much, it's easier to write a diet book and have people read it, okay? It's hard to get people to read about happiness. They don't want to hear that these methods that they thought would get them happy don't. They don't want to hear that happiness is a skill. If you want to be happy, you're going to have to do some work. You're really going to have to work at this. They don't have the time, the effort to do that. What they're going to do instead is they're going to work harder at their job to make more money. They're going to dress well to impress people. They're going to win friends and influence people, to mention a book that was popular in the early 20th century. So they're going to lead their lives the way they've been taught to lead their lives since childhood.
Well, George, you know, one thing that you're sharing and what I hear, a couple things, what you're sharing on the back end of what you just shared, what you're saying is basically people are creatures of habit, and they're going to do what's comfortable for them, and I call it the least passive resistance. So for me to do something new, even to be happy, that's called work. And unfortunately, our brains are very lazy. But, you know, if you want something bad enough, people will seek. And as you shared, okay, maybe your book, you put a lot of effort into it. And your skill set, as you were sharing, is not writing. I understand that, because that's not my skill set. But every time I write something that comes out well, I go, wow, you know what? I'm happy with myself. And I think what I believe I hear you saying is that you are proud that you were able to even put this book together. And then all the people, when you start to make the effort, who came in to support in the effort. And I believe that's what life, when we start to make those steps, I don't know, just the synergy, the law of synergy, that other things come into play to make it work. And then you find yourself, you're not alone. And there is support. And I believe what you're saying is, as you step forward, support comes. And you know what? At the end of the day, gratitude and happiness, which leads me into that, how can we learn to really love the world, everything in it, despite the violence, crime, suffering, and more?
Yes, that is the question. That is exactly what I talk about in my book. A lot of people say it cannot be done. They see the world as, you know, the violence. They see the hypocrisy. They see all the problems in the world. And as you say, it's a question of interpretation. So, for example, they can go to the Grand Canyon and see that some of the rocks don't look quite right. Well, this color isn't quite right. It's a little bit too hot today. Oh, I forgot to, you know, put my sunscreen on. It's time for lunch, okay? So here you are at the Grand Canyon, and there's splendor all around you. And you're in your head with your little thoughts. That's the way the world is for me. The world is for me the Grand Canyon. There is splendor all around me. Every place I see, there is splendor. There is the opportunity for joy and happiness everywhere. I can read the same newspapers that you read. I can see the problems in the world. I'm not saying they don't exist. They're there, okay? But they are there. And that's the way it is. That is reality. And I can just be a lover of reality. I can be a lover of the world. I can even be someone who wants to change the world without disliking it. And that's why for many people, making a change is challenging. Number one, they underestimate the difficulty. And they think, well, once they decide to change, that'll be sufficient, which it isn't. And as you pointed out, there's a part of our mind that strongly resists change. But the other thing is, when you try to get from point A to point B, it's a mistake to think that you have to reject point A. I have to label this bad and the other good in order to make that change. That's a big mistake. Mm-hmm. There was a very famous 20th century psychologist, Carl Rogers, mm-hmm. who really said it better than I can. Let me quote what he said. He said, "The curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I change." Mm-hmm. We cannot move away from what we are until we thoroughly accept what we are.
Wow,
the same is true for us and the world.
That's a good point.
So we can accept the world. We can love the world. We can have joy and gratitude for the world. And we can do our part in changing it and improving it.
That's a good point, George. Good point.
Yeah, and we have an email coming across from a listener. And again, I want to thank all of the listeners that take the time to either instant message us, send us emails, or call in. This one reads, "Happiness appears to be a topic, a top-of-the-mind topic these days, thanks to Pharrell Williams' song, Happy. Now, given music is a major part of every teen's life and adults as well, how does it fit into your everyday formula for achieving happiness?"
How does music fit in? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
that's what the question is.
That's what they're asking.
For me, I'm a lover of music. I play the piano. I'm a lover of music. Now, my wife is not a lover of music. She's a lover of art. I don't really understand art. Okay, it doesn't turn me on. It turns her on. So, you know, but for me, I'm a lover of music. So, and when I create music, I mean, the joy really flows out of me. So it's hard for me to say how it would be for other people. Are there people, I don't know what extent music can give joy to other people. It gives me tremendous joy. I just love playing the piano. I'm not a good pianist. I just love it, okay? So for me, just answering for myself, music is a large part of the joy of living. It's one of the things I do to enjoy living. I enjoy eating. I enjoy lots of other activity. I enjoy creating music. I enjoy listening to music.
Well, you know, George, it's interesting because, you know, as we're talking about music, Pharrell Williams, the song Happy, and it's top of the billboards right now. To me, it just goes to show how, as human beings, here's a song that talks about being happy and has an upbeat to it, and it's a like a number one seller. And it reminded me of years ago, there was another song called Be Happy. And it's like everybody wants it. They want to be happy, and it's a song, and it makes them feel good, but it's only for the moment. It goes to show right. that, you know, is a glass half full or half empty? And I believe when we start to look at it half full, we could be happy every day, like you're sharing. We have another question that came in from a listener. And this person is a family therapist, and they say they read a lot of books about happiness. And they purchased your book, From Seeker to Finder, last week, and found it to be one of the most profound books they said they've come across in a long time. It is engaging. It said it's an engaging read that they feel will help people make small shifts that will lead to happier life. Many thanks for giving us a great new tool to share. And it's 118 pages of power-packed goodness. So what do you say to that? What do you say to that, George?
Well, that certainly makes me happy. but I'm kidding, of course. I'm serious and I'm kidding.
Yes.
Okay? That makes me happy. Yes, I'm happy to hear that.
Right? Yes.
And it doesn't make me happy. Okay. That is, I make myself happy hearing that.
Yes.
Now, George, tell us a little bit about, we've only got a few more minutes, what is next on your horizon? Do you have something else that you're going to be working on? Are you going to continue? I know when you spoke a little bit about, in regards to education, how it is, you know, you'd like to be able to see that there were classes. You know, I tend to believe that there can, and that there should, and that there will. We just all need to recognize that the need is there and make it happen. It may take a little longer to get it in the public school system, but that doesn't mean that we can't start getting that information out there in the public school, in the private school systems, as well as just doing seminars so that people can really start shifting their focus.
And I believe, I want to add to that, Alan, I believe that the earlier, the younger we can get this type of information into our society with our youth, it's definitely going to make this place, make it a better place to live, because now our youth are going to grow up with this as part of their, I'd say part of their curriculum of life, of happiness.
Yes, I think it's much more valuable than reading, writing, and arithmetic. Reading, writing, and arithmetic are worthwhile skills, okay? Let's teach them. But if we can teach the art and science of happiness, can you imagine what this world would be like? Mm-hmm. We wouldn't necessarily have bullies in the public schools. We wouldn't have wars, people wanting more power as a way to happiness. People wanting more wealth, greed, as a way toward happiness. I mean, these things don't work. And yes, if we can get those things out there, that would be the real thing that I would love to do. And to be quite honest with you, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. And that's one of the things I've been really looking at. So now I wrote this book, What's Next? What next can I do to spread this? And I'm doing it out of gratitude. I was taught this. Someone taught it to me. And I'm going to play it forward. I'm going to do it. And that's what makes me happy. Why am I doing this? It makes me happy to make others happy.
Right.
And, what else is there to do?
And George, we appreciate you doing that. We thank you so much for it. And again, for everybody out there, if you want to find the book, you can go to FromSeekerToFinder.com. And George, I think, again, I want to thank you for coming on. And in closing, I want to talk a little bit about what you just said, which is happiness coming from knowing that you've made a positive difference in others. I'm going to play a little video here from Darnell. And Darnell is going to be talking about her mother, Donya. Please, all of you, listen and know the happiness that you can get by making a positive difference in the lives of others. Thank you, everybody, for being with us this week, and we look forward to you being with us again next week here on Answers for the Family.
So everybody, be happy.
My name is Darnell Young, and I'm desperately reaching out for help. In 1970, after a blood transfusion, my mom contracted hepatitis C, which later evolved into terminal liver cancer. A transplant is her only chance of survival, and we don't have the means to fund the surgery. My stepdad's working as much as he can, and I just got off chemotherapy myself, so I've been limited in what I can do. Any amount you could give would help our family more than you can possibly know. You can go to our fundraising website at youcaring.com. That's youcaring.com, and search One Family's Battle, ONEFAMILY'S BATTLE, and you can donate directly there. Don't forget to capitalize the first letter of all those words.